Well, aside from the World Series, a big story yesterday, at least on TV, on the Sunday talk shows, was Iran, specifically if the new sanctions announced last week by the U.S. Are going to work, if this World War III comment that the president made is helping or hurting the situation. The Bush administration says that these sanctions, which will target Iran's military, that's a first, by the way, and also target three of its largest banks, the Bush administration says this is the best way to ensure that things get resolved without a full-on war. Opponents of the idea point out that the U.S. had all kinds of sanctions against Iraq, which led to war. And we were wondering, do sanctions actually work? Well, David Courtwright is here to talk to us about it. He's author of Sanctions and the Search for Security, and he's a research fellow at Notre Dame. Hi, David.
Good morning, Luke. How are you?
Great. Thanks for coming on the show. The thing that seems to be unique about these sanctions are that they target a section of Iran's military. How does that even work exactly?
Well, they try to impose asset freezes on any finances that they may have in our country. There's a ban on their travel, flight ban, diplomatic sanctions, a whole range of targeted measures that have been in place actually for a number of years against other Iranian officials are now being imposed against these military officers as part of the Revolutionary Brigades. Yeah.
They're also sanctioning three big banks in Iran. Do you think the rest of the world's going to go along with that?
Well, not really. I mean, they're unilateral measures, but they do have a broader global impact because when the United States puts financial sanctions on these major banks, it creates uncertainty among other large banks in terms of possible investment risk, financial risk. And we've already seen over the last few months that these increasing measures on Iranian financial institutions are prompting some of the big banks in Europe to scale back their investments, their loans and credits to Iranian institutions. So they are having a global impact, a kind of a ripple impact among other major financial institutions.
Can you think of an instance or two where sanctions have actually worked?
Oh, yes. Over the last 2 decades, when sanctions have been used rather broadly, there have been a number of cases where sanctions have had a significant impact. Right now, we're seeing the impact of sanctions in Liberia. It's not been on the radar screen of many international reporters, but Liberia is going through a transition now. The Charles Taylor days are over. There's a democratic government, and the sanctions that were imposed by the UN and the US and the European Union are being gradually lifted, but in a manner that's designed to facilitate the transition of Liberia from the wars and horrors of the Charles Taylor era to the new democratic regime that exists now. So, for example, they had sanctions on diamonds. You remember the whole business about blood diamonds?
Right. Kanye West, I'm sure you're a fan.
Now there is a
or not.
now there's a new certification system in place whereby the diamonds that are coming out are certified as not related to conflict. They are being used solely for the purpose of helping the legitimate government and economy of Liberia. And the UN has helped the new government of Liberia with that transition. Same thing with their timber exports. So here's a case where sanctions were imposed. Taylor was driven out. A new democratic government has come in, and this process of imposing and then lifting sanctions has helped that process.
Well, what makes a place like Liberia work for sanctions? And then you've got Cuba, which, this is isolated island nation, and Fidel Castro is still in some form or another running that place, despite all of the U.S.'s best efforts.
It's one word, multilateral. The sanctions against Liberia were truly multilateral. You had the whole world community participating, the entire UN, the European Union, U.S., and other major players. In the case of Cuba, it's unilateral U.S. sanctions. The rest of the world does not cooperate. Most of the world thinks it's a foolish and unproductive policy. So Cuba can buy whatever it wants from Europe, any other part of the world, and these sanctions against Cuba really have had no impact over more than 40 years.
Well, if you're saying that the key is the U.S. has to have buy-in from other countries, well, talking about Iran again, one of the things that these other countries have said that the U.S. has been trying to persuade to join in these measures, they've said, we want to see these big reports that are coming out, one of them by Mohammed El-Baradei. And I see him this weekend basically telling President Bush to tone it down a little bit.
Yeah, and it's a real problem. I mean, with the Iran diplomacy, I think the Bush administration has had amazing success in getting the Security Council, the UN Security Council, to adopt two sanctions measures. Again, targeted measures against some of the senior military officials. And this is despite the opposition of Russia and China to broader measures, but they did support these two previous rounds of sanctions. That could be jeopardized if the U.S. pushes too hard with these unilateral measures. And El-Baradei, as you mentioned, is doing this report now on Iran. He's going to be coming back to the Security Council at the end of the year. And most other governments have said, let's wait to see. If Iran is actually beginning to cooperate more substantially with the Atomic Energy Agency, that would be a signal that the sanctions are starting to work, and maybe we should ease up on additional pressure to give more time for this cooperation to develop. So that's really what El-Baradei is concerned about. And you've seen similar reports, similar concerns expressed in Russia, in some of the European countries, pushing too hard on these unilateral measures against Iran, especially now while El-Baradei is doing this report, in the view of many observers, is a bit over the top and may jeopardize the cooperation we've gained over the previous couple of years.
Hey, David, it's Allison. Can I go back to your first answer? You said something, and I just wanted to follow up on it because I wasn't really clear. You mentioned that imposing the sanctions against Iran's military would put a bar on their travel and the like. I don't really understand how that works.
Well, they have travel bans and visa bans, so they designate a certain number of individuals and, in this case, the companies that the Iranian military's leaders control. And now those individuals and those companies are on a list, and those people who are and entities are not allowed to travel to the U.S., and there's a ban on their travel, and any financial assets they may have are frozen by the U.S. government. And banks in the U.S. are required to freeze them.
David, just very quickly as we go here, I just want to ask, these sanctions that are announced last week, in your opinion, do they make war with Iran more or less likely?
I'm concerned they may make it more likely because they are ratcheting up the pressure at a time when most of the world has said, let's allow the diplomatic process to work before we impose additional measures. And very importantly, they risk fracturing the diplomatic coalition that we've put together over the last year or two for united international pressure on Iran.
Well, listen, David, I just got to stop you there because we're out of time, but I do appreciate you coming on, and we'll have to have you on in the future to kind of see how this stuff shakes out.
Okay. Thanks, Luke.
Thank you. David Courtwright, author of Sanctions and the Search for Security. He's also a scholar at the University of Notre Dame.
Coming up on the Bryant Park Project, talking a little sports. It's a good time to be from Boston. The Patriots crush the opposition. The Sox sweep the series. Maybe A-Rod will go play for them. That's all coming up. Thank you so much for listening to the Bryant Park Project. Time for the segment we call The Most, in which we combine your gift for picking the most interesting stories in the web with our staff's talent for being sometimes strange, sometimes a little silly, sometimes reading the Bismarck, North Dakota Tribune. There you go. Who did that? That would be Ilya Marritz. Hi, Ilya.
I don't know why I did it.
Come closer to the microphone.
I'm Manhattan born and raised. I don't know why I did. Why I'm pretending that I'm from North Dakota, but I just have a thing for this state.
North Dakota is the new Lower East Side.
And North Dakota is so cool, and the rent is so much cheaper. So this is the number two most commented at the Bismarck North Dakota Tribune. North Dakota board approves settlement of lawsuit over Sioux nickname. The North Dakota Fighting Sioux, that's a university there, are going to have to reach some kind of agreement with the Sioux tribe within the next 3 years about whether they can use this name, the Fighting Sioux, or not. This has just completely lit up the message boards there. I'll just read to you two of the comments that I think are interesting. Well, actually, I'll just read one really racist one that I think is interesting. I would not be offended. They left off the second D. If they adopted the Fighting Whites. So this is a very active, crazy message board. If you want to head over to the North Dakota Tribune.
There was a whole backlash. I can't remember where. Remember the Fighting Whiteys, that basketball team?
I missed that one.
There was a group of a couple of years back. When this other sort of Native American mascot controversy was roiling about. A group of, I think, Native American guys started an intramural basketball team called the Fighting Whiteys to kind of make a statement, and they sold T-shirts.
Our nation's capital's football team, I won't even say, the Washington, how do you get away with that every week?
I don't know, lots of dollars. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ilya. Rachel from deep in the NPR news booth.
Hello.
Hi, Gandalf. How are you in there?
I have a story about a very old mollusk.
Are you talking like an old mollusk to like make the point?
I'm trying to make it sound very mysterious. This is a really exciting article. I don't know why, but it just intrigues me. The scientists in Iceland have dug up what they are saying is the longest lived animal, like the oldest animal ever. And it's a mollusk. And they say it's somewhere between 405 and 410 years, you know, give or take 5 years.
Sure.
Who's counting? Splitting hairs. And this mollusk is named Ming. It's like its little nickname because that's when it was born, during the Ming Dynasty in China. Just to tell you how old this thing is. And so this is a big deal because it will reveal things about how life evolves. And they determined how old this was by counting the rings on its shell. Isn't that cool?
That is cool. Does it say in the story if it's alive or dead? I mean, it's dead, I presume, now,
it's
right?
It's dead now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it used to be alive for a long
time.
It had a
good life.
Good
taken
run.
Taken so young. 405 or 410.
The most blogged story at the New York Times is about Barack Obama, that he promises a forceful stand against Clinton. That is the headline. Barack Obama gave a 53-minute interview over breakfast aboard a charter jet that took him to Chicago, and he described to these New York Times reporters that he is going to get tough, that he's going to come down from his tower, as he's been not wanting to engage in mudslinging. But now he's accusing Senator Clinton of straddling between the Giuliani-Romney side of foreign policy and the Barack Obama side of the equation. He said that she was trying to sound her vote like a Republican on national security issues, and that was bad for the country and ultimately bad for Democrats. So maybe the debates coming up will be interesting this week.
If the polls are to be believed, he better do something, because Hillary seems to be pulling away statistically. We're going to talk to Jim Vandehei, by the way, after the show, and put that up on El Blogo, so you're going to want to listen for that political discussion. One of the most read stories at the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, Arnold Schwarzenegger says marijuana, not a drug. He was being interviewed by the British edition of GQ magazine, and he was talking about a scene in a documentary called Pumping Iron back from the 70s, which shows him lighting up a fat one. And he said, "That's not a drug, it's a leaf." And he was being interviewed by a guy who's also a judge for America's Got Talent. And Schwarzenegger's press secretary said that it was the comments were made in a lighthearted context, and that everyone should remember that he was doing an interview with the host of America's Got Talent.
And that he was high. No, he wasn't.
Get down, there's no time, it's the farmer's field. It's my one line I can say like Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I think Maddie Martinez
has
some for us. Hi there.
How you doing?
Good.
Oh, good. I have the number two most emailed story right now at npr.org. I always got the npr.org stories, but actually, this is the new Robert Plant Alison Krauss album, and they were interviewed on Weekend Edition Sunday. And I happened to listen to this all weekend. Not the interview, the actual album. I just kept playing the interview over and over again. No, it's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful album. Here's a little bit of Sister Rosetta Goes Before Us. Strange things are happening every day. I hear the music up above my head. Now, here's Robert Plant and Alison Krauss in the interview this weekend explaining that it was like by no means a sure thing that the two of them could actually, you know, click and make great music together, because you think Alison Krauss, Robert Plant, how's that going to work on paper? Just does not work. Here's them explaining a little bit more.
Well, we were kind of out there trying it out. It could have been maybe in 2 or 3 days, it might not have worked, and we'd have shaken hands and said, y'all come back now. But it worked.
Come back and see us. We appreciate you.
Yeah. And I'd have had my apple cobbler and gone.
So that's a number two
wow.
email story.
Love that.
It was a fantastic interview.
Robert Plant on Hee Haw, ladies and gentlemen. I have to say, last week, I wondered aloud if Robert Plant was still alive. And he's very much alive. And
yes, he was
making
in our
a
studio.
Great record.
And feisty.
So I take that back. Robert Plant, you're alive.
And that does it for the most for this Monday. Thanks, everybody.
You're welcome.
The finder's love. I know I've loved you too much. I'll go alone.
I put together a little lineup. Luckily, Terry Francona has okayed it. Let's see who we're putting out on the field. Leading off, Jacoby Ellsbury, center field. Number two, Dustin Pedroia, second base. Number three, David Ortiz. No designated hitter. He wants to play first base. You tell him no.
That was Fred Willard reading the Red Sox starting lineup at last night's Starter World Series Game 4. All Fred forgot to announce was the name of the broom. The one the Red Sox used to sweep the World Series in just 4 games. We'll talk more about the series. A-Rod, no want to be in his Yankees contract anymore. And the first NFL American football game goes down on British turf. Bill Wolf, husband to me, friend of the BPP, and former disembodied voice on ESPN's Around the Horn to the rest of the world. Hi, hun.
Hi, baby. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing? So, did Colorado even show up for the World Series? I mean,
Yeah. Well, there were three one-run games. I mean, the game two was a 2-1 squeaker. Game three, Saturday night, which we missed because the cable went out.
The cable did go out.
They closed a 6-0 gap, 6-5.
What did we watch instead? I watched the inside of my eyelids.
I watched Ohio State beat Penn State, but okay. that's who I am. And then last night was a 4-3 game in which Colorado fell behind 4-0, but came back with a couple of home runs late and made it close. So they showed up. They just weren't as good four different. They were barely not as good three of the 4 games, and good night now.
It was exactly as you predicted last week on this very program. You said Boston had more high-priced talent and would win out in the series.
Yeah, they have more high-priced talent. That's right. They also have really great young talent, and they also traded for a bunch of great talent. I think it can be said that the Red Sox are the standard by which everybody else is judged right now. And answering a question that wasn't asked me, I think it's because they're simply better at
that doesn't happen often.
Take it easy. Don't give away the secrets, baby. It's because they assess talent better than everybody else. They have adopted the modern statistical quantitative analysis of talent, which used to be all qualitative. You know, an old guy chewing tobacco says he's fast, he can play. Well, now they look at the numbers throughout a player's career, and they make decisions based on the stats, and they wind up the best. They have the most talent. That's the best team in baseball, Boston Red Sox, no doubt about it. I'm sorry to say, it's bad news for everybody who's not a Red Sox fan.
Boston Red Sox winning the World Series. Headline, almost getting pushed off the sports pages
so good.
By this news that Alex Rodriguez, A-Rod, opting out of his 10-year,
yes.
$252 million deal.
Yep.
My first thought went to, knowing not a lot about sports, that Joe Torre leaving might have something to do with it. But would that be enough for A-Rod to give up $72 million in his final guaranteed salary? Is Torre leaving enough, or is that not even in the equation, really?
Well, I think it's in the equation, but let's just take a real-world example. I know you like your bosses very much there.
I
at
do.
The NPR.
Awesome. I do.
Let's
awesome
just
people.
Say they had signed you to a 10-year, $250 million contract, but one of them said,
your lips to God's ears.
I'm out of here. What would you do? I'd say, hey, new boss, how you doing? I'm the one who makes $25 million a year. Please pay me. I think that the cover story is that Torrey is no longer the manager and that there are a lot of other free agents that the Yankees have. So there is some question as to what the team will look like and who will be its leader next year. And so that's a very good cover story to say, well, I had to opt out because it's just not a certainty if I stay here. However, he's no fool, and his agent is a guy called Scott Boras, B-O-R-A-S, and he is one of the all-time nastiest negotiators. He's the guy who got him $252 million in the first place. And I don't think they'd make this move, excuse me, if they didn't think there was something better than $25 million a year out there for them somewhere. So I think he's looking for more money. I think that's the bottom line. I
choose to watch it, though.
It's going to be about Torrey, but I don't think that's the whole story.
Even if that is what it is, I choose to interpret it as it's like the Karate Kid. The Yankees are the big, muscular, blonde-haired Billy Zab guy who gets everything from Cobra Kai. But even with all his money and all of his glitz and glamour, he can't get the girl. He can't get Alex Rodriguez. And Alex is going to go to Milwaukee with Daniel and win the tournament. Okay, it
really
kind of breaks down at the end, but it's just nice to see the Yankees
right
not get their way for once.
Well, I never saw the Karate Kid, Luke, so I can't comment, but I'm sure that's an unbelievable metaphor.
Okay, it was terrible.
No, I'm sure it was brilliant. I interpret it as this guy, Alex Rodriguez, is the best player on the planet, and he may go down as the greatest player of all time. He is he is superhuman, and he has the option to be a free agent when the rest of the free agent market is fairly thin, meaning his price will be higher than it normally would be, which would be extremely high. And so here's a guy who's got a chance not only to make $30 million a year, but you hear rumors about deals cut with the Cubs and deals cut here and there, which might potentially include equity in the club with which he signs. I mean, if the Cubs said to him, we'll give you $25 million a year over X number of years, and then when you're done, we'll give you 5% of the team, it'd be hard to turn that down. I just think he's at a place where he can make an unbelievable deal somewhere, whether it's with the Yankees, the Red Sox, the Cubs, the Mets, the Dodgers, the Angels. Those are the teams that are being talked about. He's just in a great negotiating position, so why wouldn't he take it? It's not really that surprising.
Good weekend for Boston.
Oh,
Red Sox, obviously.
Time for Boston.
Patriots, they whomped Washington like 900-4. What was
900-3.
Okay. What was the real score?
It's 52-7.
Hey, we were actually really close.
That crossed the line into whomping.
But you're saying, you told me late last night, this morning, I don't remember, that next week's game is the one to really watch. With Boston.
Yeah, you know, we've been talking here on the BPP about how great the New England Patriots are, and they are. And then there's this other team, the Super Bowl champs, the Indianapolis Colts, starring the quarterback from all the commercials, Peyton Manning. And they're just about as good. It's hard to say who's better, the Colts or the Patriots. And yesterday the Colts put a mini whomping on the Carolina Panthers in Carolina, 31-7. And so both of these teams, New England and Indianapolis, they have been the best two teams for a number of years, they play next week in a battle of teams that hasn't been beaten and, in fact, neither one of them has really been challenged yet. Indianapolis a little more challenged than New England. And so here we go. Every year, as Luke, a sports fan, will tell you, every year there's a game of the century, which is kind of excellent. That every year there's a game of the century. So this is the game of the century this year, and this one is a big one. We'll see. The stakes really are futures. That is, whoever wins this game this week, it won't mean much this week. They're both still going to be excellent teams. Both will still be in the playoffs. But down the road, if one of these teams has a chance to be considered, you know, the greatest team of all time, which is the way it's going, this will be the game which will tip the argument in its favor, I think. So it's a big game. You don't get many regular season, non-playoff games that are this compelling and this exciting beforehand. We'll see how it turns out when they play it, but the lead up will be insane.
All right, so we'll be TiVoing that because you and I will be on an airplane.
Can't wait to be on an airplane with you, baby.
All right, that's good, I guess.
Yeah.
That's good. Hey, that'll be our anniversary.
You bet it will.
That's right, Bill Wolf.
Oh, love.
You didn't have to remind me, baby.
All right.
Exciting and new.
Greatest year of my life.
Aww.
True, baby.
Bill Wolf.
What do you want from me?
Sports guy and big old romantic.
Love
Thanks.
Is love. I'm sorry.
Okay, that's enough.
All right.
Talk to you later.
Bye, babe.
Lord.
Oh, William Wolf, ladies and gentlemen. You know, you'd think that killing 17 American soldiers in a terrorist bombing, injuring many more, would pretty much ensure a life behind bars, even in a country that takes kind of a dim view of U.S. foreign policy. But at last check, Jamal al-Badawi was convicted of the 2001 bombing of the USS Cole in Yemen. At last check, he was at his house in Yemen entertaining visitors in full view of Yemeni authorities. Now, this is the same guy who was sentenced to death at one point and escaped from prison. We're wondering how exactly this happened. And what does this say about the U.S. war on terror abroad? Michael Isikoff wrote about Jamal al-Badawi in this week's edition of Newsweek. Hi, Michael.
Good morning.
So tell me a little bit about this guy, Jamal al-Badawi, his role in the 2001 bombing of the USS Cole.
It was critical. He was the local mastermind of the operation. He was a follower of Osama bin Laden, been to Afghanistan, met with Osama, and was directed by a couple of his senior lieutenants, bin Laden's senior lieutenants, to help organize the attack on the USS Cole, October 2000. A suicide bombing of a U.S. naval warship killed 17 sailors, 39 wounded. Badawi had recruited the suicide bombers, rented the skiff that was used to attack the ship, and actually was one of the key players. And the Cole bombing is probably forgotten today, but that was a real wake-up call for U.S. officials in Washington. This happened in the latter months of the Clinton administration. There had already been the embassy bombing by al-Qaeda, but the Cole clinched it that bin Laden and al-Qaeda were out to kill Americans and were going to attack American interests all around the globe. And you may remember there was a big in the post 9/11 sort of postmortems. One of the big questions is why neither the Clinton administration in the last few months or the Bush administration in its first 9 months did anything to retaliate against the Cole bombing. Bin Laden, after the Cole bombing, actually celebrated the event, reading a poem exulting how the Cole had gone down to her doom, videotaped it, went out around the world. It was a very big moment in al-Qaeda's war against the United States. Badawi actually was confessed to his role in the bombing in January 2001 to an FBI agent named Ali Soufan, who interrogated him in Yemen. This is the big John O'Neill investigation that got lots of attention. That, you know, there was always suspicions that Yemenis weren't really cooperating, but they did allow Soufan to interrogate Badawi. He confessed. It was clinched it that this was a Al Qaeda operation. In any case, Badawi,
and he gets the death penalty, right?
In 2004, was convicted of the Cole bombing, got the death penalty. Then last year, in an act that really surprised a lot of officials, he escapes from prison, he and 22 others, looked very much like an inside job. Then just a couple of weeks ago, he turns himself in, pledges allegiance to the Yemeni president, Saleh, and is granted his freedom. And last week, as you pointed out, is greeting well-wishers at his home in Aden. This absolutely infuriated U.S. officials. I talked to Ali Soufan last week. He was just beside himself that this had happened. This guy has the blood of 17 sailors on his hands. Soufan told me, he said, mark my words, this guy will kill again. He's a fanatic follower of bin Laden.
What do you think, Michael, what do you think this says for the U.S. in terms of the U.S. is obviously not happy about this, but they can't seem to do much about it. I mean, do they just look feckless?
Right. I mean, it's a real sign of our waning influence in the region. It's hard to imagine that 3 or 4 years ago, the president of Yemen, nominally an ally, would have taken a step like this, a big poke in the eye. Look, Yemen has always been a country where there is a great deal of sympathy for al-Qaeda. Remember, bin Laden comes from a Yemeni family. There's U.S. Hostility to the United States is great. It's always been great. It's a country where cooperation with U.S. Law enforcement has never, and intelligence has never been high. But I think this is a sign again of waning influence in the region, where countries nominally allies are just not afraid to just tell the United States, forget it, we're going to deal with our own local concerns rather than yours.
Well, one of the things, Michael, I'm going to have to just stop you right there because we're almost out of time. I assume you're going to be writing about this more though, and we'll be looking forward to reading what you have to say in Newsweek magazine. Michael Isikoff of Newsweek, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Bye.
This is the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We are always available online at npr.org/Bryant Park. Hey, everybody. I'm Allison Stewart.
And I'm Luke Burbank. Coming up, we're going to talk about man and machine love. Not the gross kind, the vacuum cleaner kind.
I said nothing.
Okay, that still sounds kind of gross. People who have become very, very attached to their little robotic vacuum cleaners and even dress them up in pretty outfits. You'll want to stick around for that. First, though, we've got today's top stories from our own Rachel Martin.
This is NPR.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Argentina has elected its first woman president. Her name is Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, and this is what it sounded like yesterday when her supporters heard the election results.
Por ustedes, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner.
Kirchner replaces her own husband, President Néstor Kirchner, as Argentina's leader. Néstor Kirchner announced earlier this year he would not seek re-election and would instead support his wife's candidacy. Critics say it's part of a ploy by the couple to try to alternate terms and extend their leadership. Cristina Fernandez Kirchner easily beat out her rivals, winning well over 40% of the vote. Her election as Argentina's president comes 60 years after another famous political wife, Evita Perón, helped win women in Argentina the right to vote. The head of the United Nations Nuclear Watchdog Group said yesterday he has no evidence that Iran is actively working to build nuclear weapons. Mohammed El-Baradei leads the International Atomic Energy Agency. Speaking on CNN's Late Edition, El-Baradei said the threat posed by Iran's nuclear program has been exaggerated, and he's concerned about the growing rhetoric from the United States. Iran insists its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. Earlier this month, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice accused Iran of lying about the aim of its nuclear program.
And in other news closer to home, a fire at a beach house in North Carolina destroyed the building and left 7 people dead. A dozen college students had gathered at the beach house in the town of Ocean Isle for a weekend getaway. 6 of the 7 students killed attended the University of South Carolina. 6 others survived. One witness described seeing 3 students sitting on the ground and screaming as the house burned, and another jumping from a window into a nearby waterway. Debbie Smith is the mayor of Ocean Isle.
The whole community is devastated. We've not had this kind of tragedy at Ocean Isle ever. And that, you know, a fire is bad enough, but a loss of life is what makes it so tragic.
The cause of the fire is still under investigation. Okay, hey, listen to this.
You think it is over, but the games have just begun.
Oh, is that too scary for morning radio? Maybe. I think it's scary. That's part of the trailer from Saw 4, and it wasn't nearly enough to frighten away moviegoers this weekend. Quite the opposite. Horror fans flocked to see the Halloween perennial, which led the box office with $32.1 million in ticket sales. Since the first Saw film became a horror sensation in 2004, Lionsgate has released a new chapter each October. Debuting at number 2 this weekend was something a bit lighter, Disney's Dan in Real Life, a romance starring Steve Carell and Juliette Binoche that took in $12.1 million. Stay with us. We're going to talk more about Saw 4 and how it has impacted, or not, the horror film industry as a whole. That's the news, and it's always online at npr.org.
This is NPR.
That is scary.
Very scary, Miss Rachel.
Thank you, Rachel.
Halloween is just around the corner. Maybe you've got your outfit picked out, mm-hmm. your kid's outfit, your pet's outfit, your Roomba's outfit. You heard me, your Roomba's costume. There are people who dress up their robotic vacuums. And I got to tell you, it's not just on Halloween. A recent study from Georgia Tech showed that people become deeply attached to the little suckers, naming them, referring to them as he and she. We'll talk to one of the head researchers of that study in just a moment. But back to the people who dress up their vacuums. It seemed like a case of supply and demand to some kids in Acton, Mass., who started a costume company called My Room Bud. So I spoke with the Smith brothers, 16-year-old Tyler and 13-year-old Niles, just before they went to school, and they gave me the skinny on the Roomba costume business. Okay, Tyler, tell me the kind of costumes you make for the Roombas.
Well, we try to turn the iRobot Roombas into pets. Our originals were cows and leopards and tigers and zebras. Since we've added a French maid, that actually sells a lot, too.
Now that it's Halloween, Niles, have you decided to branch out a little bit more? Costumes like the French maid?
Well, we're thinking about making a dog and a cat. And we're thinking about creating a Halloween special, which might be a pumpkin.
Excellent idea. I think that's an excellent idea. So, Tyler, how did you guys get started?
Well, about 2 years ago, we found out that my mom wanted a pair of cowboy boots for Christmas. And to make some extra pocket money for Christmas shopping, we started the Roomba business. And after Christmas had taken off, so much that we decided to keep it going, and so now we have the My Roomba business.
Tyler, why do you think grown adults who just spent a couple of $100 on a robot vacuum want to dress it up in a costume?
One of my personal opinions is it's the same thing that got my brother Griffin liking the Roomba. When he first saw it, he saw it going around the floor, and it looked like an animal, and the costumes really turned it into an animal even more. So that's, I think, what attracts grown-ups as much as my brother.
Niles, how's business? How many orders are you guys getting?
For business, we're very close to selling about 800 Roombuds. Our goal is to sell 1,000 by the end of the year. In November and December, we get about 5 to 10 a day. But on the average day, we only get 1 or 2.
Well, good luck, you guys. I'm going to suggest an elf Roomba for Christmas.
That sounds interesting. We're thinking a reindeer, actually.
That's good, too. So I guess you have to go out there and get a lot of red-green felt and some little antlers and stuff.
Definitely.
Hey, Niles and Tyler, thanks for being with us.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
They were already a step ahead of me. I love that. Mm-hmm. Reindeer Roombuds. Okay, now to the science of this story about vacuum attachment. Researchers at Georgia Tech scoured the internet and found control groups of Roomba-attached individuals who have gotten emotionally involved with the little robots. A member of the research team joins us. Ja-Young Sung is a graduate student at Georgia Tech who studies emotional design. Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
So what were some of the reasons that people gave you for their attachment to these little robot vacuums?
Okay, so if you look at the data deep down, the one reason that comes before everything else is a practical benefit of it. So people feel the Roomba does the work that you don't want to do, and for some people, Roomba even does a better job than themselves. So in the work, Roomba makes the cleaning so much easier, increases cleaning frequency, and consequently increases the cleanliness of the home so people can maintain a cleaner house without much less effort. So, of course, that brings into people appreciate for the work they do, and they want to return the service that Roomba does for them.
So they're grateful to the vacuums for keeping the house clean, so therefore they have an attachment because they become grateful to them.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, and there's one more thing to it. And the Roomba is a robot that moves autonomously, and people tend to react anthropomorphically to the unit. So they thank, they praise Roomba, and they even reprimand Roomba if it doesn't behave themselves. So, you know, that also combined with a benefit that Roomba brings.
So they scold the Roomba? They've been known to scold them?
Yep.
Oh, my goodness. You study emotional design, and I know that's a big part of it. So if you can kind of explain to us what emotional design is and tell us how that design of the Roombas help people to become so involved.
Okay, so emotional design is a design that makes people, that bonds people with technology in a personally meaningful way. So make you care about the technology and want to talk about it to other people. So emotional design can be anything as simple as I have an iPhone and that's so sleek and I'm a cool person. And that's also part of emotion. To the point that I really care about it, I don't want it to break, that's also emotional design. So the way Roomba is designed, it was never anticipated from the beginning. It's not meant to be bond with people because it's a vacuum cleaner, you know. But it moves. And it actually, you know, the interesting thing is that Roomba bumps into the walls and it moves randomly. So the random movement really triggers people that it's like a human being. And it triggers so much of anthropomorphic power that they really relate Roomba with something that's living, that's alive.
Something I think is interesting is the company that makes Roomba, iRobot, they also make robots for the military. They have in the past some of these robots that would pick up bombs and go into dangerous situations. Now, those are decidedly not cute robots. Now, right. You make a point that original Roombas broke down a lot. A lot of people didn't think that was particularly cute. Yet the fact that the product is cute is one of the reasons that people become so loving towards them.
I have to kind of disagree with that because even for the military robot, the soldiers get so much emotional attached to it.
Do they really?
They name their bombing robots. And so an iRobot person told me that when I visited Fair, they said the soldier actually called the customer center and says, like, can you please fix my, I forgot the name, but the name of the robot, which was a female name. And, of course, I was not in the status that can be fixed, so the soldier was very sad.
So I guess I stand corrected. War robots are cute, too, or meaningful as well.
Or it's really lonely over there.
So in your research, did you find anybody having the opposite reaction to Roombas, people who really had an unrealistic dislike for them?
Of course. The same reason. So if people get emotionally attached to it, they will forgive the Roomba for your Roomba being Roomba breakdown, but on the other hand, if they don't like Roomba, they will not ever forgive it. One of my participants didn't even know where his Roomba was. He used it, he let it clean, and it got stuck under the furniture some years ago, and he forgot about it. He totally forgot. And one day he realized, oh, my Roomba's gone, but I don't care. I don't like it. And another participant, her dog was so afraid of it, like to the point that it really drove the dog crazy, so she stopped using it.
It's a fascinating study, something I never thought somebody'd get that involved with, but you made it very interesting for us. Jia Young Song is a grad student at Georgia Tech who studies emotional design. She was part of that research team that compiled a study on Roomba culture. Hey, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
You know, my sisters used to have a vacuum cleaner they would sing into because it was one of those upright ones, and the back handle of it was about microphone height.
Wow.
And I was actually back at the Burbank Family Ranch in Silverdale, Washington this weekend. And I decided it was time to make my little brothers and my kid miserable by subjecting them to their first ever viewing of The Shining.
Here's Johnny.
They were so scared that my kid, anyway, she had to actually plug her ears and her eyes. She started out just closing her eyes, but then the sound was actually too scary.
I'm trying to picture that. Okay, I can do that.
She had her, like, North Face hoodie pulled up over her eyes and then had her ears plugged. Well, you know, with Saw 4, it's Saw 4, is that what
Saw
we're on
4.
Now? Doing all kinds of business this weekend at the box office. Halloween coming up this Wednesday. We thought we should talk scary movies, how to survive them. We've got just the guy here. Seth Graham Smith is the author of How to Survive a Horror Movie, All the Skills to Dodge the Kills. He's also the creator of a website, dodgethekills.com. Hi, Seth.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Great. Saw movies did a tremendous amount of business this weekend, $32.1 million.
Yeah.
What's the appeal?
Well, you know, people, it's the same thing that makes people get on a roller coaster and scare themselves half to death. You know, they like the experience of confronting something and how that feels to scare yourself and challenge yourself in some way. I don't know what it is about us, but we seem to feel the need to put ourselves through all sorts of unnaturally scary situations.
It seems, though, that scary movies, I mean, and we're going back a ways now, maybe 5 years or so, but they have really, really kind of had a resurgence. Is there something culturally about us that we're more into being scared, particularly by these kinds of very gory movies?
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there is a cultural component to it, but the component that I tend to pay more attention to is the business component of it. People have realized in Hollywood, again, that horror movies are very, very profitable because they appeal to the biggest movie-going base, which is teenagers, and they're very cheap to make. And as you see, they're still very, very popular. I was ready to come on here and tell you guys about, you know, well, it's not like it was 3 years ago when a horror movie was number one every weekend, but apparently, America has yet to get a case of horror fatigue.
Well, let's hear what was turning out $32.1 million this weekend. This is a clip from Saw 4. This is the Jigsaw Killer running one of his tests.
Officer Rigg, your first test. The person in front of you is in desperate need of help, but it is not your job to save them. You view this person as a victim, but if you were to see what I see, beneath the mask lies a criminal undeserving of the life she leads. Your obsession tells you to save the victim. I tell you to walk away. The choice is yours.
Yikes.
Yikes.
do you think that these movies like Saw, it's like you're locked in a basement, you have to cut off your head to be free with a goldfish cracker. I mean, is there a point at which this gore is going to be just like too much for people?
Yeah, I think that you're already starting to see, I think Saw is really the only, there's a subgenre of horror movies that these films belong to, which is called torture porn. Mm. And it really kicked off with movies like Hostel and the original Saw, you know, it, not so much focused on scares, traditional scares like somebody lurking in the dark and popping out and everybody in the audience jumps out of their seat in unison, but almost films that challenge you to keep your eyes on the screen. And I think that torture porn genre is diminished, and I think it's sort of going away. Although, who knows, $32.1 million this weekend.
Mm. If you had to pick, with Halloween coming up on Wednesday, what's you know, in your top five scary movies, what should people...
In my canon of...
yes.
I tend to go, well, The Shining, I mean, how can you go wrong?
Or as Janitor Willie calls it, The Shining.
The Shining, right, Exactly. The Exorcist has to be up there. The original Nightmare on Elm Street is up there. Rosemary's Baby. I tend to go for the psychological scares over the gore, because you know those are the things that are really scary to me. When I was a kid of 8 or 9 years old, I saw The Shining for the first time, and it took me years to realize what is so viscerally scary about that movie. It's the fact that a little kid trust its parent more than anything in the whole world, and the fact that parent would go crazy and try to kill it with an axe. I mean, come on.
Yeah, it was no less terrifying at age 31 watching it this weekend than it was when I saw it when I was like 10. Well, Seth, we didn't get a chance to play a clip from your website, but I want to highly recommend people go to dodgethekills.com. It's really funny and really interesting, and we'll have to have you on in the future to talk more about that, okay?
Thanks very much.
Thanks. That's Seth Graham Smith, horror movie lover, director of dodgethekills.com, author of How to Survive a Horror Movie.
Another hour of the BPP has come and gone. Thanks for listening. But you know what? We're always available online. We'll have a wrap-up of the weekend's political news with Jim Vandehei of Politico.com, plus my bake-off. It's not my fault these ladies had put spinach and brownies. That's all I'm saying. I just followed the recipe, people. I'll give you our reviews.
It tastes like sadness. Is that a flavor profile? Anyway, it will be now.
NPR.org/Bryant Park. I'm Allison Stewart.
I'm Luke Burbank. Bye.